Hi, I'm Lawrence Diamond.
And I'm Bob Matthews.
And this is The Process of Production.
Hi mate, how's your week been?
Yeah, it's been a nice one actually, rolling into Christmas now, getting ready for that. And obviously the whole music industry from top to bottom, I feel, goes Spotify Wrapped crazy this year.
Yeah, there's been a lot of that. Yeah,
and it's a strange and weird thing, which I'm sure lots of people have different opinions about.
Including myself, yeah.
Yeah, I sort of missed it with the bands I was in. Obviously, Spotify was a thing, but this sort of world hadn't begun.
Yeah, no.
But we did get a little insight into it because you get one from your podcast.
Right.
Which I was sort of surprised about. And obviously, you know, we're not like the Daily from the New York Times, but we did find out that we did chart in the top 30 music podcasts in the middle of the year.
Yeah.
So that was a really nice little Easter egg, summer Easter egg.
Christmas stocking filler, maybe?
Yeah, Christmas stocking filler, yeah. And also, it is nice to see all the time you guys have spent listening to us. We really appreciate that. I didn't stick it all over my gram.
Yeah.
But I did take like a nice little like, oh, that is nice to see.
There's been a bit too much of that on social media. We don't need to add to it. But yeah, yeah,
sure.
I when we started this at the beginning of the year, we didn't really have a clue how many people would end up listening to it. And it's nice that this podcast has become a real thing that people actually are out there listening to every week. And that's more than we could really have hoped for. So it's, you know, it's great.
Yeah. And it's become a cornerstone of our kind of working week.
Totally.
Working fortnight.
Yes.
And I love one of my favorite things when I used to tour America was collecting words that don't translate. So they don't have fortnight in America.
Yeah, yeah.
Though I'm sure now they do because of the computer game. But so like every 2 weeks, if you're in America, every 2 weeks. And actually that sort of leads on to what's kind of coming next for the podcast.
Yeah. Speaking of Wrapped, we're going to wrap things up for the year after this episode and go on a bit of a winter break.
Yeah, when we started the podcast, we kind of gathered a whole load of interviews to kind of get ourselves going, and then we've been doing it week to week. And there's been a few guests we really want to get on, and we've sort of talked about getting dates for them, but there may be it's harder for them to kind of slip in an evening in a fortnight period. So we've sort of lined a few up to track over the Christmas and winter break. And our plan is to come back to you in the new year with a whole raft of new episodes. So today will be the end of series one like the end of our first run.
Yeah.
And we will be back bigger, brighter and better in 2022.
That's right.
And I guess this week to end the year is a guy called Jim Lowe. And I think we were looking at our guests, and I really apologize to any of our guests if I'm totally missing a trick.
Mm.
But I think Jim is the first person we've interviewed with a bona fide number one British chart single. On his Palmeiras.
Yeah, we've definitely done producers with number one albums, haven't we? But I don't know.
Yeah.
Did you go through the list? You know, Charlie might have done.
Charlie, that's a good point. Charlie Hugel.
He might have done Ed Sheeran's song. I don't know.
Ah, yeah, that's a good point.
Was that a number one single? Yeah. Well, we'll check it. We'll check this and get back
we'll
to
check
you.
We'll check our stats.
Yeah.
But in terms of kind of helming that kind of
producing a number one UK single. Yeah.
Yes. And also not just a number one single, but like quite a definitive song for quite a definitive British act, which is Dakota for Stereophonics.
Right.
And I really remember this record coming out.
Mm.
My sister was a very big Stereophonics fan. Shout out to my sister, Sarah. And they were an established rock band, but they had sort of become an album artist, and they were very much in that world of like big arena shows and albums and maybe not, you know, Capital FM chart world. And then this song just landed, and they had a synthesizer on it, and it had a, you know, a massive chorus, and it was like the definitive rock song of that year in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it's up there with sort of Mr. Brightside by The Killers. It's like the most heard records of the last 20 years. Like
that's funny you said that, because I was just thinking like there's Seven Nation Army, there's Mr. Brightside, and then there kind of is that song.
From a UK band, you know, maybe a Franz Ferdinand track would be up there, but like Dakota is kind of still played on radio. You hear it in the shops all the time. You hear it on TV. It's really become part of
the British rock music fabric. So it was really interesting to hear Jim talk about the production of that.
Yeah, so Jim came on and started working with Stereophonics a few years before that single, and he's kind of become their in-house guy since then.
They're George Martin, as it were.
Exactly, yeah. So by the time they got to Dakota, he was kind of their go-to producer. Yeah, and we hear a bit about that decision to put some synths on that record and how it led to the changing the direction of the album. And
yeah, and Noel Gallagher sending Kelly Jones texts about it to wind him up for using a synthesizer, yeah, which probably in 2005 seemed like a very big deal. But
yeah,
I think we're post the guitar versus synthesizer wars. We're well past those now.
That's in the rear view.
So big shout out to Jim. Big shout out to a gentleman called Mathieu Bertin, who me and Bob have worked with, his band Reckless Jacks. He introed us to Jim. They've done some work together. So big shout out to Matt as well.
Yeah, and he wasn't wrong about Jim being a fountain of good stories. And
yes. Yeah, we got, there's Christopher Lee, there's Glenn Matlock, there's Herbie Hancock. There's a whole load of good stuff in this interview.
Yeah, so we should get to it, shouldn't we? Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it. And we'll see you on the other side. Jim Lowe is a Grammy Award-winning engineer, musician, producer, and mixer, most famous for his work as the long-term right-hand man to Welsh rock band The Stereophonics. Starting out as an engineer at the Nomis Studios in London, he made his step from the engineering chair to the production chair when Kelly Jones, the band's lead singer, reached out to him to initially engineer demo sessions for the band's fourth record. The two immediately struck up a fruitful working relationship. By the time the band came to record what would become their fifth album, Language, Sex, Violence, Other, Jim had transitioned to the producer's chair. It was a move that would prove fruitful for both band and producer, as the debut single from that album, Dakota, driven by Jim's program synths and more electronic influences, rocketed to number one. Jim has continued his relationship with the band through another five albums, as well as helming work by The Charlatans and ex-Sex Pistol Glenn Matlock. He's also continued building up his stellar mixing CV that already includes the Dandy Warhols, Taylor Swift, and Amy McDonald. In this interview, we get the story of what it's like producing a number one song like Dakota, the Grammy Jim didn't even know he'd won, and the beauty of Abbey Road's Room 1 when the band is cooking. But we start by hearing about the space Jim works in his home outside London.
I built completely soundproof this place so I can play drums at midnight if I need to.
And do you mix from there as well, I guess?
Yeah.
That's like your space.
I mean, it's not, I've tried to sort of acoustically design it myself and just winged it. but in a small room, it's just so difficult to get acoustics right.
Sure.
Especially the bass.
So many reflective.
The bass just... end and stuff. It's just a nightmare. I had people quoting me, you know, like £80,000 to kind of do my studio properly. And I was just like, no, forget it. I'm going to...
No.
I just use my own logic.
You know, and your ears, like,
just your ears
and space. Yeah.
Actually, I used to have a studio at a place called Townhouse Studios, was a great studio, and had a set up there. And then that shut down, so I had to move back home. And I basically set up in my daughter's bedroom. Right. It was a tiny little room. It had a bunk bed on one side, and I had my stuff on the other. And I mixed tons of stuff in there.
Amazing.
I mixed a Dandy Warhols album in there.
Nice.
On headphones or?
No, on speakers.
Properly done.
But
amazing.
Mainly when I'm mixing, I listen really quietly anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
And so reflections are less of an issue and bass traps are less of an issue.
Exactly, all of that stuff. And also it preserves your ears, and you can just hear so much more if you get sort of tuned in.
Amazing.
That's a really good point. I think the temptation, depending on what stage of the process you're at, is to just crank the speakers because it's exciting and it's
absolutely
fun,
yeah. I mean, when I go and do recording sessions, you know, everyone's excited, I'm excited, you're getting the drum sound together, and that's a great time to really pump the volume up. And I'm totally weird. I can either have to blast the volume or go really quiet, and I can't listen anywhere in the middle.
Right.
I had another mixer tell me that, Craig Sylvie. He said he only ever listens like really quiet or absolutely cranked.
Oh, right. That's good to know.
Yeah. Well, what's your philosophy behind that then? Is it more?
Cranking is for like sort of excitement factor. Most big monitors in studios are sort of, they vary so much and you don't really know what you're listening to.
Mm.
You know, I used to always take my speakers with me wherever I went, which were KRK V6.
Okay.
And I've actually got the same set of speakers that I still use now.
Brilliant.
That I've used since 2004. I've never changed my speakers.
Great.
So I've got them and I've got some NS10s. Actually, the best mixes I've always done have been on NS10s.
Just that knowledge of how they're sounding in whatever room they're in, you can your ears are like molded to them almost.
If you get really tuned into NS10s, you'll probably do the best mixes. You know, they don't always have, you know, the low end accuracy obviously to work out, but you can either attach to it
But so it's just about knowing your setup, really, rather than having a perfect room.
It's working the limitations. You know, every room has its... And once you listen to some stuff and take it out and then bring it back.
And that sort of leads into our first question. Did you sort of came up in that almost that traditional studio setup that was sort of still there at Gnomis, wasn't it?
Yeah, I feel like I caught the last boat.
Right, that's good. Interesting you said that, because that is one of my notes. I was like, I feel like you must have been right at the end of that.
I was right at the cross. I first got into a studio in about 1993. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a big studio called Gnomis, and it was a complex that had 6 rehearsal rooms and 2 recording studios.
Cool.
And I started off in the rehearsal rooms, learning the live sound.
Right.
And then a job came available in the recording studio, the SSL room. And when I first walked in there, you know, I was like, I didn't have a clue how any of it worked. I had done a course. Yeah. I was sort of doing a course, actually, at Kingston University.
Yeah. All right.
Doing the Represent. Gateway course. And it was like a year course, but a job came up in the studio after about 5 months. Right. And I jacked the course in and took the job in the studio.
And that was like a career pathway that you could do, right? You could kind of...
Yeah, I mean,
I got some work
experience. You know, I sat in reception. In the evenings, I would get into the live rooms. But there were some fantastic bands in there. You know, you'd have Iggy Pop in one room. You'd have Duran Duran in the room next door. Paul Weller in another room. It was a completely vibey place with loads of terrific acts, big acts coming in and out. So, for example, I remember one evening I was sat in reception. Iggy Pop was in one of the rooms. Half the PA went down. You know, Jim, can you come and sort this out? I remember crawling around on the floor, like trying to find this cable because, you know, something wasn't working. And the band never stopped, you know, and I'm like crawling literally under Iggy's, you know, feet. You know,
as he's rocking out and
he's rocking out and I'm like, and yeah, I fixed it and went back to the desk.
And did you learn, I suppose you learn a lot about the technicalities, but I suppose you also learn a lot about just being around people like that, like Paul Weller and Iggy Pop.
Yeah,
and
I mean, it becomes so the norm in a way. You know, when you first get there, obviously you're starstruck with these people, but after a while, it's just like, this is where these people come and do work. Yeah. And luckily, back then, there was an opportunity to get in a studio and learn from, you know, the great people above. You know, so I was an assistant to Spike Stent, Alan Mulder, Dave Bascom, whatever great kind of mixer, producer, engineer was coming in, you'd just be the guy sat in the corner being the tape operator. And, you know, you could just sit quietly and watch.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when they've gone, you check the desk out and see what they've...
yeah, how they've patched it.
You know, oh, right, how did they... Yeah, okay, right, I see they've added... top end to everything. Okay, that's a good start.
And when did you first get a chance to be the main man in the studio, so to speak?
Well, it was a gradual... I used to practice on bands that used to come in the studio, you know? So you'd be on a session and then the session would finish, you'd have a day off, I would get in there, work out stuff, you know? And then a band would come in on a budget or some freebie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the studio would say, well, you've got to use the in-house... you know, assistant, whatever. And then I would practice on them. So yeah, I self-taught and self-driven.
Yeah.
Really. I remember being on a session as an assistant and the A&R guy came down about midnight and I'm just sat in the corner, you know, half asleep. He listens to this mix that this guy had done. He came and said, God, it sounds awful. It was like midnight. He said, now who, he said to the producer and the band, well, you know, it's midnight. You know, who are we going to get to mix this stuff by tomorrow? And I put my hand up in the corner and said, I'll do it.
Wow. Right.
You know? And they all look round at me like, oh my God, you know.
He speaks.
What are you doing talking? and I did it. And yeah, he liked it. So I I just threw myself in at the deep end there.
One of the early acts you worked with is Glenn Matlock, right?
From
the Sex Pistols. That must have been... quite an experience to work with someone like that, and quite early on, I guess.
It was actually. I was an in-house engineer. You know, I progressed, just going back to what we're saying. From an assistant, I then became like the in-house engineer. You know, I sort of stuck at it long enough. But having said that, if you don't get it right, you can end up being an assistant too long.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. And if you're going to make that leap, there has to be a moment where you kind of
Yeah. It's a different story for everybody. Everybody does their own hard work, and then some people luck out, and you know, it's so random. There's no certificate that's going to get you on the next level.
Yes.
It's just see how your path goes, and fingers crossed. So Glenn, I was the in-house engineer. Glenn came in for a session, you know, and of course, it's a big deal. Oh my God, he's a Sex Pistol, you know. You imagine he's going to come and walking in the room, you know, spitting on the floor or whatever. and he was a very nice guy, and we got on. We did some tracks, and I've sort of remained friends with him ever since. And obviously, I'm in his band now, and
playing bass player for the.
I was playing a
bass player,
which is kind of intimidating, but he'd kind of teach me as well, you know.
Amazing.
I could play anyway, but he was very good. He'd only give me little pointers here and there, you know.
Right.
So I've really learned a lot from him.
And then obviously the kind of the big step into the big production chair comes with the work with Kelly and Stereophonics.
Yeah, I mean, I got locked in with them. It started off really, I was still at the studio working at Gnomis, and their manager at the time, a guy called John Brand, rang up the studio and said, we need some live stuff mixing. Have you got anyone at the studio who could do a mix of a live rock band? And someone said, I think Jim Lowe could do it.
Great. Nice.
And their live engineer, I think, was on holiday at the time. So anyway, I got sent the stuff.
Yeah.
I mixed it, and the band heard it and liked it.
Great.
And then they were going on an arena tour, but this is about 2002. And John, the manager, said, do you want to come and record the tour? And
fantastic.
So I did it. I was set up underneath the stage on my own with a Pro Tools rig. In all these arenas around the country.
Wow. Amazing.
And it was just so weird. I mean, I had the band above me, I had 12,000 people out front, and I was just in this dark void under the stage, and all I had to do was just hit the space bar to record and hit the space bar to stop. And I hope none of it crashed.
Yeah. Amazing.
So, and then off the back of that, I got a call from Kelly asking me if I could I do any sort of drum programming, mm-hmm. and could I teach him how to work Logic, because he wanted to put some demos down.
Yeah.
So we met up in a small little studio. You know, by this point they'd had a couple of number one albums, you know, so it was quite...
Doing arena tours.
So it was really... Yeah. It was quite nerve-wracking for me to think I'm going to go into a little room with Kelly and do that. Went in and we just really hit it off. I programmed a couple of drum loops, which really got him inspired with a couple of tracks.
Cool.
It sort of seemed to flow straight away. And just by, our sort of speed of working together formed quite a good relationship early on.
So this long, working partnership you formed with Stereophonics is kind of just built on a good vibe with Kelly.
I always want to be prepared and set up and ready to go, mm-hmm. you know? And mm-hmm. I can see from Kelly and a lot of artists, you know, they've got the ideas in their head. They just want to get on and get it down.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be f***ing around. Am I allowed to swear on this? I don't want to be messing around with a microphone for too long and miss the moment. And Kelly liked the fact I was kind of on it straight away.
I think, Jim, we might be wrong, but we think you're the first person we've interviewed who has produced a bona fide number one UK single.
Yes, I know. That was
on the charts. And I'm sure you get asked about it a lot. But
yeah.
How was that kind of the moment the first time you heard the song and then feeling?
That started off, we book into a little studio in Shepherd's Bush called The Stone Room. I'm not sure if that's still there. Kelly had just come back from holiday and he walks in the studio and plays me Dakota, which at that point was called Vermilion.
Okay.
Okay, the name was only changed later on. But
right.
So he played me this song on an unplugged Strat, I think, or something. And straight away I said, I think that's the best pop song you've written.
Oh, mate. I mean, right, you heard it there.
I just heard it. I just said it. I thought this is... Because I said to Kelly, previously, about... He'd written a lot of stuff that was quite, had a swing to it,
Mm.
And I said, you don't really write stuff that's quite straight, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know.
Yes.
And we'd also seen The Strokes, I think, that previous 6 months in Japan. And so he comes back with this song, which is da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, God, that, you know, that's quite Strokesy, isn't it? It sounds... And he said, okay, we'll make it sound different. I'm going to go and set my guitar up in the live room. Yeah. And when we lay down these demos, it's only me and him initially, really. So anyway, he goes and sets his guitar up. I program up a real quick drum beat. Uh-huh. Literally, you know, kick, snare. And my drum fill was the double snare hit. Dun, dun.
Yeah.
Which obviously becomes a hook. So I did that. He puts the guitar down. And then, to make it sound different, I created an arpeggiated synth. Messed around with the sound, and then that suddenly literally just sparked off this is a completely new sound we're making for this band.
Yeah, because it kind of sparked that fifth album sound.
It really did. It was fresh. It was, the previous stuff was a bit more Americana. It was more acoustic, you know.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So it was a real angular change. And that day flowed very well. You know, we started at 10 and we were finished by 6. And we got the whole song down.
And I've read in another interview that you've done that you tried re-recording elements of that track later on in the process and went back to a lot of the parts you got in the demo.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the guitars were done on a pod, you know.
Yeah, lovely stuff,
The Line 6.
The Line 6 pod. And we just basically rattled through this song, one idea after another. Then we were going to go to Hook End Manor to do the album properly, set it all up. And yeah, that process, like, well, this sounds good, but we're missing something. So Kelly's like, okay, we'll just take that back from the demo.
Yeah.
So I took that, and then I took something else, and I took something else. And then actually we only ended up replacing the drums and a couple of vocal things.
Kelly said that, like, when he got a text from Noel and said, that's your first number one and there's a synthesizer on it. And, like, did you have, was it a thoughtful process, or was it just like, everything's open and Jim's bringing a synth and we'll let the band dive into that?
I think you don't ever want to box yourself into a corner.
Mm, sure.
You know, and you never know. Obviously, when you're working with certain bands or whatever, they have their sound. And, you know, I think it's good to kind of try different things. And none of it was conscious decision. It was just like, let's just try that.
And it sounds good. Like, let's get it in.
Yeah, oh, that sounds cool. Don't question, you know, there's always that thing in your back of head. Are people going to like this? Oh God, it sounds a bit different for us. Or do you know what? Just have fun with it. And if it feels right, just roll with it.
And sort of talking about that, was there a moment maybe with the label or with the band where you're starting to go, I think we've got a live one here. Like, was there a...
Yeah, there was. We knew we had something special with that one.
Yeah.
And actually, when we finished doing all the demos for that album, we made up a CD and we put Dakota at the front of track one, and we invited the record company guy down and we plonked him in a chair, turned the volume up, and we sat at the back with some champagne.
Yes.
I think it was just a Friday night.
And
we kind of knew, like, when he hears this song, he's gonna love this.
Yeah.
And sure enough, after about 30 seconds, he spins around in his chair. It's like The Voice. goes, thumbs up.
Brilliant.
Amazing.
You know, it just had a magic, and certain songs just have this... You know, and it's fantastic to see them live and see that song live.
I was going to ask that when you work on a song like Dakota and it is such a huge hit and it goes on to have this whole life, what's that like kind of seeing that? And obviously it's then out of your hands and it's in the world, but that must be such a great feeling.
Of course, it's, you know, when you're working stuff in the studio, you don't, once it leaves that room, that's, you know, until people actually hear it and say things about it, you don't really know if people are going to like it or...
Yeah.
But when you hear positive feedback from people, it's just amazing. You know, it's lovely to see that even now, you know, 18 years later, whatever it is, people are still really... It still sounds fresh as well.
You still hear it all the time. You still
hear it
everywhere.
You don't know how things are going to date. And of course, everything you try and create after that is... You've set yourself a very high standard, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point. Has that been an issue then?
Well, you do get those... There's that, you know, loose thought in the back of your head. Well, you know, we've got to create something as good as that. Or we're never going to create something as good as that
And is that resisting the temptation to try and replicate it? Because
yeah, I don't think you want to try and replicate it.
Yeah, because you can't. And even if you did, it wouldn't necessarily do the same thing.
It wouldn't do the same thing. And just certain songs land exactly at the right time.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, I think it's like with all music. That song could have landed, last year and maybe not done as well. I don't know.
We've found quite a few of the producers we've interviewed have found that during lockdown, they realized how much better vocal performances they were getting, often with people that they were working with remotely on an SM7, because that person just felt totally relaxed at their kitchen table.
It's definitely a weird thing. I mean, doing vocals in a big studio, you know, when you've got the distance from a control room to a live room, I've never thought is a good idea. You're just better to be in a more intimate situation, I think, you know?
Yeah,
I agree.
You're sort of closer to each other, and you can sort of just relate to the what you
feel feel the intangible electricity kind of.
I mean, I think some people obviously like to perform in the studio with a whole lot of people in the control room and like a performance.
Yes, a lot of people have sort of talked about how you're almost like an extra band member because you are a musician as well.
Well, yeah, you do become the fifth Beatle, whatever it is, you know.
But I suppose there is a production technique where you're the sort of gurus one step removed, but you're kind of in at the coalface. That's like...
Yeah, because I can engineer and, with them, certainly for quite a few records, I was just flat out, engineering, programming, producing with Kelly.
Yeah.
And then mixing it,
Yeah.
And I'm very lucky that I've learned all those skills and managed to sort of integrate them into one... thing
work,
which is very useful, I think, for producers, like great producers, maybe someone like Hugh Padgham, who did Police and stuff, fantastic engineer. Like when you've got the sound in your head, it's much quicker just to go and dial it in. And I love working with bands, and I can hear the sound, and then rather than telling another engineer, okay, can you get this kind of sound, I've just got it in my head and I can get it.
Great.
Yeah.
So that makes a nice, easy flow kind of situation.
Is that one of the plus points of being kind of the in-house producer for a band for so long, is that you get to know the shorthand of the sounds that you can reach for and the sounds that they might need?
Yeah, exactly. And you know...
What are the ups and downs of being embedded in one band for so long, I suppose?
Of course, it's like being in EastEnders. I mean, you get typecast a little bit. Well, of course, it's like with anything. It's like if because I've done so much stuff with Stereophonics, I've done so much stuff with loads of people, but I've just had more success with Stereophonics.
Sure.
Sure. Yes.
So people go, okay, well, that's what Jim does, I mean, no one would have a clue that I love working on all sorts of stuff, And music is music.
Yeah.
It's all waveforms to me.
Have I done my research right here that you produced Christopher Lee?
I did do a session with Christopher Lee, which was probably one of the most memorable, weird sessions I ever did. It was a studio in a house.
Okay.
It was all on these machines called DA88, which were like digital tapes, a bit like ADAT.
Okay.
Each machine had 8 tracks on it. And I had 5 machines all synced together. It was a 40 track. So you put your 5 tapes in, tracks 1 to 8, 9 to 16, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
While Christopher Lee's in a taxi on the way to the studio, I thought, I'm just going to put these tapes in and make sure they work. And I had 2 sets of these tapes. So I put the first set in. Great. They play. They all sync up. Lovely. Then I hit eject. One of the tapes doesn't come out.
Oh no.
So I'm literally there thinking how to get a screwdriver and like hoof this tape out, and then with that the doorbell rings and it's Christopher Lee, and I'm like, oh my god, that was close. Yeah. Anyway, so I started doing the session, and it was like an opera thing in all these different languages, German, Spanish.
Oh, wow. Sure.
And I was just there, me, his producer, who kind of looked like a vampire himself, and Christopher Lee in the live room, And it was just so, it was so full on. It was just such a nightmare. It was like five of these machines, Christopher Lee singing in Spanish, you know?
Yeah.
And this weird producer guy breathing down my neck, thinking, is he going to sink his teeth into my neck every minute?
In a haunted house.
So the pressure was just on.
Yeah, that's big.
And actually, when we'd done the recording and the producer sort of disappeared, and it was basically, I was sat at the desk and I'll turn around and Christopher Lee sort of sat directly behind me on the chair. You know, just totally intimidating.
Nice
the whole
guy.
Thing. He was fine. He was nice. You know, we spent a few days doing this.
Right. You consummate know. Pro, I imagine.
Yeah, he really was.
Mm. I'm actually looking at a DA88. There's one for 150 quid on eBay.
Oh, right.
Relive your nightmares anytime, Jim.
Don't get it. They're awful. But anyway, it was
also
a good session.
Just kind of jumping onto sessions as well. You worked on a Herbie Hancock record that you got a Grammy for.
Yeah, that was... the funny thing about that is I didn't realise I had a Grammy for 2 years.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's quite... I was just at home one day and I thought, God, I wonder what happened to that Herbie Hancock record I worked on. And then I dial some stuff up. Oh, you know, Grammy Award winning record. I need a certificate or something. Yeah, yeah, well, Jim, yeah, we've had your certificate here for the last couple of years. We're trying to get hold of you. I'm like, well, you know, I'm not sure why they didn't get hold of my manager at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I fired my manager after that.
was that just a session that you ended up being in and was it in London? And
it was in London. They were over here. It was a great session. I didn't really realise who was going to be playing on it until I got to the studio. You know, Vinnie Colaiuta on drums, Jeff Beck on guitar.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, wow, this, you know, Studio One at Abbey Road. And Herbie had this amazing piano flown in from Holland, you know, Bösendorf or something. So that was a whole effort to set this piano up. So we'd set the piano up. I think he played on it for about 10 minutes and then switched onto his digital Yamaha keyboard.
Once you've got that set up, like, I know it's always a job, but if it's Jeff Beck and Herbie Hancock in room one at Abbey Road, do you occasionally stand back as a, you know, as you were saying earlier, as a fan of music and just be like...
Yeah, well, you do. I mean, I've always been like that, as in, how did I end up here?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah. I've always treated every day like it's day one. You know, my enthusiasm and love for it is just, you know, I treat every session like this is the first time I'm doing this.
That's great.
You know, I've never I don't get complacent with it. And I think the minute you get complacent with it, it's time to stop.
And is that why you've always kind of enjoyed doing, like, even when you're kind of working on a Stereophonics album that's probably going to go to number one, you're still working with emerging artists and upcoming
Absolutely.
Artists?
Absolutely. I really apply the same rule to everybody. There's loads of great talent out there. Everyone needs a chance to have their voice with stuff. So, yeah, I'll do deals with people and, you know, help them and work with them. Yeah, you know, and really it doesn't matter important. If I'm working with Kelly or, you know, an unknown singer, I'm still giving my best and trying to make it as good as I can, you know. Mm.
Just jumping to another end of the spectrum, you mixed Teardrops on My Guitar for Taylor Swift, is that right?
Yeah, that was a radio mix.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think off the back of Dakota and stuff, which everyone was going, this sounds amazing on the radio. Mm. Well, of course, you know, when I finished the mix in the studio, I would just thought, I love the sound of this. I didn't question, is it going to sound good on the radio? I just like the sound of it.
That's interesting. You
know? We'd always do a car test. We'd burn a CD when we'd go and sit in the car. So off the back of that, people were like, let's get Jim to do a radio mix because it sounds great on the radio. And yeah, I did a Taylor Swift, a couple of her tracks.
Did you get a little bit of guitar on it as well? Did you overdub some guitar?
I did, yeah. I put a... I don't know if she really knows this, but she might now.
Hopefully she'll.
Yeah, I replaced. Well, the A&R guy said, can you lose some of those banjos and stick
right,
a guitar
sure.
on?
Did they want to make it a little less country? And
a little. They were struggling to get something on Radio 2 or something.
Was there that period after Dakota, I suppose, where you're suddenly working in that world of like, oh, it's a radio hit and it's number one? Did you kind of start having to have those slightly more unusual conversations with A&R about what records should be and how you deliver them? And I mean, the Taylor Swift machine must be vast as well. And
Yeah, you'd get the odd call for staff, but it wasn't like the floodgates were open and
right.
You can have success with all this stuff, and you're always kind of on the starting grid.
Once it's over, you're back to the beginning.
Yeah, you know. I mean, some people are very lucky, and one thing leaps from one thing to another. I sort of feel like I've had less of a steep climb up, you know, but yeah, a consistency and still working and producing music and rock and roll. And for me, that's an achievement, I think.
It's a huge achievement.
Yeah, that's sort of the dream.
Shakespeare once said that music is the food of love. But what is the food of music? As much as the right microphone or guitar amp, what we eat or drink can be such a crucial part of a recording session. So each week, we like to ask our guests, what do they cook or order to get the mood right in the studio?
When I was an assistant, I cannot tell you how many hours I spent going to the local kebab shop.
Right, okay.
Okay, you know, it's like 10, 11 o'clock at night. Oh, let's get Jim, the assistant, to get down to and go and get a kebab.
Oh, God, yeah. I
think as an engineer, there's two ways to go. You can either eat too much and get fat, or you can smoke too much and get thin. And I took the smoking route.
Okay, got you. Nice.
Let's start with your favourite studio space you've ever worked in.
I suppose I really like ICP Studios in Belgium.
Oh, cool.
They've got an SSL room there. I've done a couple of records there. We did a Graffiti on the Train there and Keep the Village Alive. And I did another couple of records there. It's just a nice atmosphere in the live area.
I did a session there and they've just got everything. Like you walk
they've
into
got everything.
Room,
it's a really clever way just to waste loads of money and time.
Yes, completely.
Yeah, no, I've been here 4 weeks and I'm still trying out the right distortion pedal.
What's your favourite plugin?
This is a dangerous question, isn't it? For some reason, Melodyne sticks in my mind.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah, we haven't had that before.
I think Melodyne, you know, is a useful tool. And it's probably one plugin that I would need on any session.
Yeah, it's really good at what it does.
It's great, you know. I use it. When I'm working with vocalists, especially just get the best out of them, get the best comping. If there's the odd little word to tweak, then I find Melodyne's great for that.
Nice one. And then moving into the physical realm, what's your favorite piece of hardware?
God, there's so many bits of hardware.
Mm.
I mean, I've also got a MXR Blueface flanger.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know what, I've always been obsessed with flangers stuff, you know, and I've realised with a lot of the plugins, you know, they nearly get it right, but it's not quite, you know, it's the difference between, like, putting skim milk on your cornflakes and double cream.
Mm. Yeah.
You know? It's just got that extra kind of...
And there's something quite real world about a flanger as well, like the effect itself.
It really is.
Tangible, isn't it? It's like a really...
And I've A-B'd that against the plugin because I'm so sad. And there's a big difference, you know.
Fantastic. What's your favourite synth?
Prophet 5.
Good.
That was a real certainty.
That was a definite certainty. I've got a bunch of analog synths and they all do something slightly different. I love the Jupiter 4 actually as well. But the Prophet 5's really versatile and just sounds amazing.
Nice.
Fantastic.
Last is, what's your favourite microphone?
Probably AKG C12.
Oh, nice. I don't have
which
one.
Which is, no, I don't either. I have to rent one in if we need one.
Mm.
I think it's an all-round lovely mic. It's really lovely on vocals. You can use it on anything, really.
We've got two more regular questions that we have for every episode. And the first one is your favorite production. So you can either one that you've worked on or a production that you heard and sort of was the thing that made you think, wow, you know, that's how a record should sound.
There's so many, obviously.
Sure.
But I have to say Pink Floyd, The Wall is an all-rounder for me.
Yeah.
It's really well put together. It sounds fantastic. So I'm going to go Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Lovely. Nice choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In your opinion, what's the most important tool at your disposal as a producer?
my shovel. Dig myself out of the ish that I'm gonna tell people.
I like it.
Okay, the most useful tool I think is just collaboration.
Okay. Nice. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
As a producer, you're there. You know, it's not your show. You know, you're there to work with the band and just people and just get the best out of what they've got and just learn how to collaborate and work with them.
Perfect.
Yeah, I think
that's great.
But you can use the shovel if you want as well.
Yeah.
We may use both.
Keep the shovel.
Yeah, keep the shovel bit.
Well, actually, Bob, before we dive into my takeaways, I do want to just confirm we did a little deep dive on Wikipedia while we were listening to Jim, and You Need Me, I Don't Need You by Ed Sheeran, produced by former guest Charlie Hugel, peaked at number 4 on the British chart. So an absolutely, again, seminal single from the noughties, but I do think Dakota is our first number one single on the process of production.
That actually came out in 2011, so technically not the noughties.
Oh man, I'm all over the show. But I actually say the noughties and I mean the tens, because it's tough. It's tough to go from the 90s to the noughties.
Let's just go for this millennium. Yeah.
Yeah, this millennium. Yes. Two seminal songs from this millennium, and Dakota is the number one. And I thought it was interesting what Jim said, and we were sort of talking about this just conversationally over a coffee, like that moment you take the leap, you can work hard, you can do your thing, and it cannot happen.
Yeah.
And it can often be chance or serendipity, or, you know, you've got to put the work in. But, you know, Jim just got that call to be the live engineer, and then he was sort of assisting Kelly to learn Logic, and because he had this skill set that slowly grew, and then comes in with this song. Jim hears the magic in it, has an idea for it, and next thing you know, you're producing a massive rock band and you're having number one single.
Yeah, I think the way that Jim's career's gone gave him a really good perspective on this, and he's kind of seen it from both angles, because he got quite an interesting break the way he got into producing such big records. But then he's also tempered that with his career hasn't necessarily gone stratospheric whereas other people's has. So, you know, he talked about this kind of slow rise, which is maybe a bit more sustainable. And
yeah, he talked about that, didn't he? He said, like, you know, some people like zoom up the mountain, but he's actually managed to build, with Dakota being just, for lots of people, it'd be a pinnacle, but for him, it was also a gateway and also a path to like working at that level. But yeah, it wasn't like big ticks as he climbed up. I think also like being involved with a song that has life like that must be such an exciting thing, even though it's probably what he talks about most when he does do interviews. That frisson of magic when you know you've got a live one must be a really amazing thing to
Well, it was
around.
Cool, wasn't it? Because we talk to people who've worked on big records and they often say that they had no idea what it was going to do. But in this case, they kind of did.
Yeah, they sort
I guess
did,
when you're
already
a big band, you know that your song is going to get heard. And if you've got a really strong feeling that it's a hit, then the rest will be taken care of.
Yeah, definitely. But I do think there was something about that song that, If you remember the time, like, it really did give the Stereophonics a new avenue that they'd maybe not had before.
Yeah.
And that's also something Jim talked about. Like, he helped the band not get stereotyped.
Yeah, that's true.
And that can be important for a producer to kind of, when you're working with an artist, to know their strengths, but also help open up new places for them to go.
Yeah, maybe if Dakota had come out sounding too much like the Strokes, it would have been dismissed.
Or if it had sounded too much like Performance and Cocktails, you know, which, like their previous records, it might have not quite had the same space. And that was obviously Jim's role.
Yeah, just a side note, I listened back to it this morning and I noticed like the lead vocals got like really quite a heavy delay on it, that I think if someone said to me, mix this, it's going to be a massive hit record, I probably would have shied away from that. It's just like interesting point that you can have like quite intense effects on the lead vocal in a big hit single.
Yeah, well, and I think he alluded to that as well, isn't he? He's like, we knew we had a big one, but he also was like, he sort of dismissed that idea that we sort of suggested, like, was the label breathing down your neck? He was like, no, we just mixed it to sound good.
Yeah,
we just wanted to enjoy it.
And that's the way to be. You mentioned how he's worked hard to make sure the Stereophonics didn't get typecast. Could you say that's almost been at the expense of him being typecast as a producer? He kind of alluded to the fact that no one thinks of him as doing anything else other than the Stereophonics because he's worked so closely with them through his career, and that can be a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, I think he called it like being in EastEnders, didn't he? And I think I'd very happily be in EastEnders if it meant I got to produce like those kind of records. And he didn't mention it as much in this interview, but in some of the reading I did, that idea of being the extra band member.
Yeah.
And I guess coming from bands, I quite like that idea. And we've talked about how often the best work you do is with, you know, actually, I think there's two things. Sometimes you spend a day with someone, the first thing you do is the moment of magic, and actually don't labor the relationship.
Yeah.
And then other times I find it's better like to grow that relationship.
There's a real blueprint for it with producers like Nigel Godrich and his relationship with Radiohead.
Mm.
You know, you've been incredibly fruitful. And Jim, it's a different vibe with Stereophonics, but that it's a similar relationship he's got going on there.
And you find it, I mean, obviously the big like hip-hop records or the big pop records, there's often loads of producers. But The Weeknd works with one or two producers for large swathes of his records, and you get that understanding, you get that comfort. There's no right way, but I think you've got to say it's a positive.
Yeah.
Like to have produced, you know, you can produce 50 bands and never produce four number
one. You've got to go with it. Yeah. And it's easy to look and think, oh, what if I'd been had a bit more of a diverse career? But yeah, he may not have ever had the success that he's managed with Stereophonics. And, you know, it's been incredible.
And we didn't really talk about it, but he actually has a more diverse career as a mixer, which we sort of alluded to with the kind of Dandy Warhols, Taylor Swift and stuff. And there was an interesting takeaway from that you took as well.
just early on, he was talking about his room and his listening habits, and the fact that he does a lot of his mixing at low levels, I think, is quite interesting. And I'm such a bad one for just reaching for the volume knob to kind of make me feel excited about what I'm working on. And it's something that I've heard before, like I mentioned in the interview with Craig Sylvie, and I just wonder if it's something that I could be doing more when, like, you know, trying to make decisions about stuff and not being influenced by the loudspeakers.
There's probably a slight disconnect often when a lot of the work you do, you've produced it and then you're coming to mix it. So you've had it pumping in the room, as Jim said he does when you're getting the drum sound in, or you're the vocal, and you want the person in the room to be excited.
Yeah.
And maybe, there needs to be a disconnect, the stop. The artist leaves the room, or the day comes, you mix it, and you're like, it's low level. And that also obviously sort of helps with not having an amazingly treated room.
Yeah.
So you're not getting like banging reflections off every surface. The speakers he's mixed on for 14 years, they're less than £1,000 for a pair. So, you know,
That was surprising to me, actually. Yeah, I kind of always thought that it's at a certain level, you need to invest like 10K in these amazing loudspeakers. But if he's doing these mixes on a pair of KRK V6s, they're not out of reach. You know, your average
budget, if you say.
Yeah, you know, I just think that's quite inspiring. And like, you know, the people who tell you that you need to be mixing on these insane speakers, maybe they're wrong, and that's cool.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And again, it's horses for courses, isn't it? It's like, maybe if you're mixing a Bollywood soundtrack, or if you're doing the latest Hans Zimmer soundtrack for like Dolby Surround, but if it's a song and it's got a vibe, get it. And also, you know,
it's just about knowing them.
You know where it works.
Yeah. And he was big on the NS10s as well, which are classically like not very exciting speakers. Like if you put your mix on low volume on NS10s, it's going to have to be really good to sound exciting. So I guess that's the scary thing about listening at low volumes. It's like, I'm actually going to have to face up that this mix isn't very good.
And one of the last takeaways I took, and I think it's quite interesting because it's one of the first takeaways we took when we spoke to Tim Brown.
Oh, right.
Back earlier in the year, was this thing about, you know, vocal takes on SM7s or vocal takes in like very relaxed atmospheres.
Yeah. Well, whether this thing is tracking in the control room or off in a big live room or a vocal booth, you know.
Yeah, Jim was very much, obviously he came from that Noma studio background with the big vocal booth, and he sort of talked about even just the physical disconnect of like having to walk through a live room to be like, oh, do you need a glass of water, and how are you feeling, and oh, it's sounding good in there, you know, and like we're all in there and you're here, and I'm not a vocalist, but I always had the sort of romantic notion of the vocal.
Yeah, I guess it depends if you feel like you want to perform it when you're recording. Like some singers channel their live performance energy when they're tracking, and in that case, you want to let them feel like they're going up onto a stage.
Yes.
But others want to feel as comfortable as possible and like they're feeling at home. And then I think being in the control room is the better bet. Also, it's just rarer and rarer that you go in a studio with a proper live room these days. So most singers are used to tracking demos in the room with the producer.
I think a lot of producers have realized through lockdown that SM7 or that handheld SM58, they're loving how it sounds, even if they've not, as it gets sent to them from the vocalist. And, you know, Daniel Lanois was in like the biggest studios in the world, but it was always him and Bono in the control room with an SM58. So he'd obviously realised that early on.
I was watching Some Kind of Monster again recently, and Hetfield's always just in the live room holding an SM7, like belting into it.
Yeah, a guitarist wouldn't come in after like 2 years on the road and it'd be like, you know that guitar that you've just spent 2 years getting used to using? We're now going to give you a completely different one and put you in a really weird space. You're going to the singer. You'd be singing these songs on stage, SM58, like surrounded by the noise.
Exactly.
Get into it.
Well, this could be a nice way to wrap up episode 20. We've come full circle on some stuff that we started learning back in episode 1, talking to Tim Brann, and we've got another take on it here in episode 20 at the end of 2021.
And we started with Tim Brann, who produced London Grammar albums, which were number one albums. So we got to hear the insight on how you do that. And we've ended with a number one single from Jim Lowe. So we've had some amazing stories in between, and we'll put a few stuff on the socials from our guests.
Across the year.
Through the year, over Christmas and stuff. Thanks for spending the year with us. We've really enjoyed it. And we'll see you in 2022.
Have a great Christmas and a happy new year. And we'll be back with a bang in the new year.
See you then.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Process of Production this week. If you enjoyed it, please give us a follow and maybe even a 5-star review on whatever platform you listen to your podcasts on. It really helps. And please get in touch if you have any thoughts on the show, questions you'd like answered, or producers you'd like to see featured. We'd love to hear from you. Our Instagram is @processofproduction and our email is processofproductionpodcast@gmail.com.